Welcome back to the Machine Learning Street Talk YouTube channel. Today we have got Alex Bayesian-Stanlake again. We wanted to go down the rabbit hole on capsule networks. Do you remember capsule networks, the thing that Geoffrey Hinton invented in 2011 or so? Everyone talks a good game about capsule networks, but can we really use them and how do they work? These are some of the things that we're going to be wrestling with in today's episode. But for the first half an hour or so, we talk about Chapter 7 of Kenneth Stanley's Why Greatness Can't Be Planned. Now, this book is hugely inspirational for me, but it's also a bit divisive because Keith does not share my love of this book. I hope you like, comment, and subscribe. Don't forget, and we'll see you back next week.
Welcome back today with my two compadres, MIT Dr. Keith Duggar and Alex Bayesian-Stanlake. How's it going, guys?
Wonderful. It's an excellent evening.
He stole the Bayesian title. Now, that's just
wrong. Yeah. In today's episode, we wanted to cover a couple of things. So first of all, we spoke about the algo shambles a few weeks ago. And a lot of that was talking about how the government wanted to standardize the grades in the UK. And I've been reading a really interesting book by Kenneth Stanley called Greatness Cannot Be Planned. And his philosophy is essentially that we have a tyranny of objectives. And objectives are the worst possible form of groupthink. That when you have objectives, it completely stifles innovation, and also it completely disrupts the system because everything becomes about the objective. And when you try to directly optimize an objective, it causes all sorts of strange side effects. So I've got chapter 7 of Why Greatness Cannot Be Planned, and he quotes Campbell's Law, which is well known in the social sciences. It says, the more any quantitative social indicator is used for social decision making, the more subject it will be to corruption pressures and the more apt it will be to distort and corrupt social processes it's intended to monitor.
It's a staple. The more you use a metric as a target, the less its value as a metric is like a watchword in any sort of quantitative social science domain. Anyone that's self-aware enough to be wary of such traps.
Yeah, but I think this is more just about making sure that the objectives are designed in such a way that they correlate in a meaningful way to whatever it is we're trying to achieve as a society. Let's just simplify it. Suppose we're back in say the early in the 1940s or 1930s, where we actually had people who were computers calculating, running calculations for us. And suppose I go, okay, hey, I'm going to have this objective where we give you this test and we see how many numbers you can add together in 30 minutes. And then based off of that, we're going to hire the top, whatever, 20%. Would we be complaining if their instructors and teachers were manipulating them to perform better and better on that exam? No, because they're actually just causing them to perform better and better at the actual job that they're going to do. Well, so the objective is very closely tied to what they actually need to do to be productive or what society needs them to do for some particular application. Great. Yeah. Manipulate away.
So I think Stanley's thesis is that there's a couple of problems with these kind of grand optimization schemes. And one is deception. So he says that every grand optimization problem has deception. And also a lot of people think in this metric world, we think that we should be able to directly measure improvement. And if we continuously measure improvement between where we are now and where our goal is, it will monotonically increase. There's no acceptance that sometimes things have to get worse before they get better. A classic example of this is the so-called Chinese finger trap. And this is what Stanley, he cites this many times in his book. He says, the economy could be stuck in a Chinese finger trap. A decrease might be needed to produce a much larger increase. In fact, economists recognize that relying too heavily on GDP makes little sense. While in practice, it's the most widely touted economic indicator, this paradox has been called GDP fetishism. So just like test scores, indicators like GDP can become less meaningful as they are directly optimized.
There is like some logic here, though, right? That if we do have a simple task and we know it well enough, we can quantitize it and put a metric on it and directly optimize for that. But Stanley even grants here that generally the sorts of simple, like there is a place for these simple indicators and it's for simple tasks. And the sorts of problems, maybe calculating at a certain speed is a simple task. But what happens when you come up against that limit and you need to find a new way to calculate numbers faster? He's kind of point that, or that he makes within this chapter, is that you can optimize up to a point, but if you need to make that jump to a new technique, then relying on the numbers just keeps you trapped because you don't have the space for the rethink that may be required. And it's not to say that it's useless, but
Maybe because I do like Keith's example, because it seems like that's just cognitive ability and there are no shortcuts. Because with so many things, for example, the way that the teachers generate the tests, maybe there's some pattern to it and the students will essentially memorize how to pass this test, and that they don't
or a
really
pool
need
of questions
to,
and they get a hold of the questions ahead of time and memorize all 250 of them, even though there's only 50 on the test. But no, but the other thing too is, and we did read that book, and I thought a lot of it was presented in a very kind of false dilemma kind of way, like you have to do either one or the other. And I think people have, for as long as people been around, there's always been the crazy inventor that's trying to violate the second law of thermodynamics or whatever, and the garage, like Bill Gates in his garage doing something innovative, and he was a dropout, right, from Harvard. It's not like we ban that activity. We do both things at the same time as a civilization. We have objectives, and we may have some very rigid kind of procedures that are optimizing away, and they get however far they get, and then they hit a dead end or deadlock. But at the same time, there are innovators out there thinking outside the box in parallel, coming up with alternative systems. And then once those are born, then they get optimized in the same way that the previous ones do. And at some point they surpass like prior technologies, right? Like this, both are happening in parallel.
And I think they're useful in different regimes too. If taking the example of education, if we're looking at preventing school or helping schools that are in real trouble, those sorts of quantitative indicators are pretty good, because the problem here is there are probably funding problems, skills problems that need to be rectified. But if we're talking about like how to push things forward, there's like a transition zone where the numbers, the metrics become less and less useful. And I think that the argument that it is a false dilemma, and that there is room for both of these approaches, I think that has a lot of merit.
That's true. I mean, this is about treasure hunting. I think Keith Stanley's big point is that we need to be treasure hunters, and we need to sometimes go in the way which seems antithetical to the direction towards our objectives. He cites the example of Steve Jobs. He says that even Steve Jobs said he had no idea what he wanted to do. He did exactly what he wanted to do, which was to explore. It's just that in our culture, exploring without a clear objective seems so flawed and misguided that not even Steve Jobs had the word to say it positively. Who knows what the next generation might discover without the weight of all of the usual milestones and plans upon them.
So when somebody comes along and says, hey, look, there's this great idea and it's a silver bullet that 100% solves every problem, it's hard sometimes to frame an argument against that, because I'm not saying it never works. I'm just saying it's not the panacea. So there are plenty of counterexamples. So in my mind, the space program of the United States, let's say in the 60s, when Kennedy just set an objective to land a man on the moon before the decade was out, that's an objective. And I don't even know how many people and amounts of money was thrust towards that objective in many different paths, innovative paths, optimization paths, et cetera. And then ultimately, we got a man on the moon. And furthermore, that program has spurred all kinds of innovation and development of other technologies that nobody thought ahead of time that they would need, but they came up with because they were trying to achieve this objective. So it's just not black and white. This falls into the bucket to me of old ideas that are presented as new ideas that are silver bullets, because we've been doing this for a long time, maybe not in the same names. Let's just take a simple example. Ant colony optimization, for example, right? It's a very simple algorithm where you sort of have these agents that start off randomly looking around. And when they find something, some resource that they need, like sugar or something, then they go back to the colony. And when they move around, they leave behind a little pheromone trail that decays, right? But they're also encoded to occasionally have errors, like instead of following the path to just branch off somewhere else in search of novelty, right? In search of new resources. I feel like, these aren't the droids you're looking for. Like there's nothing really new here.
You're talking about exploration versus exploitation, but Stanley makes the argument that linking those two together still creates a convergent search, not a divergent search.
Yeah, it's the convergence that's the problem. And there are alternatives here, like explicitly coding for exploration as a goal. That's a far more open-ended sort of thing. To thinking about like designing products or designing solutions to a problem, there are certain techniques people apply involving reframing how you think about the problem. Moving from, you know, how do we just do this thing better? But the key example here is Steve Jobs. It's not how do we make a better MP3 player? It's how do we help people enjoy music more? Framing the problem in a more open-ended term does give you an objective, right? It does give you something that you can navigate by. It gives you your man on the moon by the end of the decade. But it's not so restrictive in that it locks you into a particular path to get there. If they said, oh, we need to make the Saturn III rocket, you know, powerful enough to do it, they may not have discovered the Saturn Vs, or like it may have locked out certain technological paths. It would be interesting to see if that can be like fully operationalized within reinforcement learning research, or whether or not that's just a nightmare of non-convergent algorithm that never do anything remotely useful. But I'd like to think maybe there is some merit in this idea of goals without convergence, goals without fixed solutions, just trying to make problems more open-ended more generally.
Yeah, we're going to do a follow-up show on this anyway, but in Stanley's book, he gives loads of examples in maze solving, for example, where by directly optimizing for solving the maze, you shoot yourself in the foot. And the best way to solve the maze are these kind of quality diversity type algorithms or novelty search algorithms. But let's also talk about the issue of perverse incentives, because I think that's quite interesting. He says here that another extreme form of Campbell's law, which we just cited before, is a perverse incentive. He cites the example of India during British rule. The government tried to exterminate venomous snakes by paying citizens for every dead snake they handed over, but it didn't work out very well. It led to citizens breeding cobras just to kill them for bounty.
That's right.
And ultimately the number of venomous snakes in India went up, and there are other examples of this. So in Hanoi the same thing happened with rats. So the policy didn't lead to fewer rats, but it led to rat farms. And again, he cites in the book here that aiming to reduce abusing drugs can result in the paradoxical increase. Paying workers for each fragment of dinosaur bones will lead to folks smashing the bones. Paying executives with bonuses for higher earnings leads to short-term profits but longer-term disaster. So he says here that these examples show that deception isn't confined to algorithms and evolution. It's very widespread.
Yeah, but we've had mathematics to think about and find ways to better frame problems for, that's game theory. Like how do I set a kind of payoff or system or whatever that achieves the goal that I want to achieve without these kinds of shenanigans. And just to bring it back to the algo shambles in there, 15, right? If you have fewer than 15 students in the class, we do algorithm A. If it's more than 15, we do algorithm B. That's going to create all kinds of perverse incentives. Like the one we brought up was, now all of a sudden they have an incentive to keep their class size at 15. So if it's more than 15, maybe they're going to split it up, or if they're already at 15 and some new student wants to join the school, too bad, don't have room for you. Maybe a solution there would have been to do something where it's this weighted combination. Like it's the number of students divided by 15, or some kind of linear kind of progression between algorithm A and algorithm B. And then that way there's no clear cutoff there or some nonlinear combination of things. I'm sure a game theory expert could tell us how to design that to where they wouldn't be perversely incentivized to do it at exactly 15. That it would be very hard for them to figure out whether or not it was actually ever beneficial for them to restrict the class size or not.
I agree with you on that, but on standardizing test scores, I think the idea there was all about being able to compare if someone in Birmingham is doing badly, that would be somewhat comparable to someone in London. But again, he points out in this book that obsession with standardized tests in education can result in improvements mostly in test-taking skills and memorization. It's not really helping the kids learn the subject, but it's also demoralizing. It reduces the autonomy of the teachers, right? Because if they come up with something innovative, they can't really share those innovations with their colleagues. They're just, it's almost like a tyranny of the standardized tests and being forced to think in this kind of monolithic way.
Yeah, well, I think we're moving the goalposts here and changing context. So I'm specifically talking about the perverse incentive of having a magic number in a formula used for significant social outcomes. I'm saying we can avoid those quite easily without trashing our idea of objectives or mathematical formulas and going to some brand new non-convergent social system. We don't have to do that.
I call shenanigans here just because, like, game theory is a useful tool, undoubtedly. And properly thinking through how we structure these things does have advantages. But then there's always an incentive to cheat. And maths, no matter how well structured, can't always capture the subtlety, nuance, and variety of human behavior. Like, that would be a heck of an equation to really write something that is unbreakable in this sort of system. It's not that I don't think it's a good idea to apply what we know to these problems and try and reduce perverse incentives to try and reduce people gaming the system, but I don't see it as really feasible. I just think there's too many edge cases that need to be considered and accounted for, and even then people will come up with things that no one sitting around the table designing this thing will have actually thought of.
I'm always an advocate of simplicity, and I've seen too many examples of where very simple, slight changes to the scheme actually eliminated the sort of perverse incentive problem. And I'm going to probably get some of these details wrong, but before the United States had, before prescription drugs were covered by federal Medicare, there were states that were experimenting with kind of paying for them themselves. I think one state was Washington or Oregon or somewhere. And so they started covering prescription drugs. And then, of course, doctors get all these lavish trips to Hawaii and sort of things by drug manufacturer to sell their new version of aspirin for 50 times as much. So that doesn't even really work that much better. And so they had this cost overrun, right? This problem of all this stuff getting prescribed instead of just the cheap generics. So the modification they made to the system was extremely simple. They just said, okay, fine, you can still prescribe whatever medication you think is best for your patients. However, if it's not on this kind of list of best bang for the buck medications that we've created, you need to fill out a few paragraphs justifying why they need this other medication. And just making the doctor spend a few minutes of their time filling out paragraphs virtually eliminated this problem, right? So there are these little clever things, and sometimes you have to just experimentally try them out. But I'm just saying we've been able to do that well before this book was written. So we don't need novelty search to achieve this.
Well, that's really interesting. If you think that we could analytically figure out where people are taking shortcuts and abusing the system and then just redesign the system to stop that from happening.
But do tests, do A-B testing, right? Like, try it out at one. We have to test because, look, I agree with you, Alex. This is far too complex for any maths to solve, including the math of novelty search. So we just have to test and be clever.
But even then, it might, because we have a similar problem with machine learning algorithms. They take shortcuts and do weird things and perverse things happen and unintended consequences. But here you might find that in Birmingham, because of some colloquial cultural thing, something happens. And then in London, something else happens. And how would you even come up with a best solution that works as well as it can do?
Distributed government. No one size fits all solution. Yeah. Well, look, we probably know as scientists and engineers, right? The only scalable control systems are distributed. Like, we shouldn't be trying to build yet greater monolithic, monopolistic government systems. We need to go back to distributing more of the power to lower layers of our governmental network, if you will.
Indeed. But I must admit, though, I am signed on to Stanley's thesis in general. I am a big believer that this concept of treasure hunting is a really good one. And by having groupthink, we can really be cutting ourselves off. And I want to just show an image from from his book. So this is talking about pick breeder. I won't go into too much detail on this because we're going to cover it properly. I'm even making a video about it. But the idea is you can go to this website called pickbreeder.com.
And you're even putting them on your wall. You're getting some of those printed out.
Absolutely. And behind the scenes, it's using compositional pattern producing networks. And then you can choose a couple of parents and you can breed them together and it creates a new stepping stone. And it serves a really illustrative point here because humans go onto this pickbreeder.com and they get bored after a while, but they'll breed a whole bunch of images that they like. And probably humans have certain priors about the types of images that they like. So they probably have a kind of anthropocentric or even heliocentric view of what looks good. But the core concept is that all of the intermediate stepping stones look nothing like the objective. If you tried to breed a skull from the beginning, you would not be able to make a skull. And the same goes for so many things. If you wanted to make computers, you wouldn't have realized that you needed to create valves before. And people did spend 10 years making valves before they made computers. So in almost every single problem, we have this notion that the metric needs to monotonically increase between where we are now and where we want to end up. And actually, there's this concept called the false compass, which means we do not know what the intermediate stepping stones are between where we are now and where we want to go.
That more or less made the argument that I'd make, that sometimes metrics are useful. They're a guiding light, but where we start to take them as the thing with which we're testing against, when we lose sight of the fact that they're metrics, they're not targets, that's where the problems start. Like I live in China, obviously. It's not too bad here in the south of the country at the moment, but a couple of years ago in Beijing, the pollution was horrible. Like you'd breathe outside and it would hurt your lungs. And that was a result of like rampant GDP targeting. Now, they do some interesting things here on a social level in terms of distributed government and experimenting. And that's not something that you tend to associate with. You think of China, you think, oh, big government. It's almost feudal in structure, right? There's a lot of distributed authority, a lot of experimentation going on. And it's only just recently that they've woken up to the fact that, hey, chasing all these numbers, it got us to a point, but now we have all these other problems that we need to deal with, the significantly threatening things. And certainly in some of the more interesting organizations I've had the pleasure of like working alongside and chatting to over the years, the ones that recognize the value of metrics but don't take them too seriously, that kind of know when to ignore them, they tend to do more innovative things. They tend to be a bit more freewheeling and they tend to feel like they're going further. Yeah, like I'm not saying let's throw out the books per se. I'm not saying let's go to a complete freewheeling version. I think you're right with the distributing authority, like distributing decision-making down to the people who are actually affected by things so that they can find unique solutions to their particular problems. Not building a monolithic system is a good thing. Being able to keep an eye on things is good, but the more we rigorously move things to like very tight metrics, the more we're going to move towards that big centralized model where one case must fit all. And I guess that's the crux of of Campbell's argument as I read it.
So I want to comment on that pick breeder because, okay, he's saying when people use my system, pick breeder, and they go in the way that they would naturally go, they just don't end up with what they want to. Like, okay, is that a comment on something fundamental about the universe or just a comment on, let's say, the basis functions within pick breeder? Suppose the classic portrait artist, right? Like when Rembrandt went to paint a portrait, did he grab a paintbrush that randomly splayed curved stuff on his canvas and then try to combine them in some wacky way to get a portrait? No, he just started building it up piece by piece with a precise instrument and ended up with fantastic, realistic, beautiful portraits, right?
But you've just proven my point.
Yeah.
Because the thing is, anything wonderful which we want is not designed, it is discovered.
Furthermore, when you're teaching someone how to paint, the first thing you do is you stop trying to get them to paint the object and start to paint the shapes.
The pieces, you teach them techniques, like you teach them how to put ink or paint on a page to achieve certain small effects. And then over time, they learn how to combine those pieces into a whole.
I can't draw to save my life, but if I'm trying to draw you two guys, I'm going to start drawing faces and stuff like that. But everyone I know that has any sort of talent says, nah, you got to forget about that. You need to think in this way that's counterintuitive. It's kind of opposite of how you think you'd learn to draw. And eventually, yeah, you start worrying about the details, but that's because you've got all these abstractions that are necessarily a step away from the direct route to what you want.
I do see both your points though, because there are certain skills. For example, if you want to paint, you need to know how to paint. You need to know about brush strokes and you need to be able to use a canvas and so on. But that's just the substrate. It's similar to it. For us to exploit planet Earth, we need to be able to breathe air and we need to be able to see. And then it means that we can largely exploit the Earth. But once you have that substrate or base of skills, then you need to do what might appear to be completely backwards or random things, completely counterintuitive to what you know, in order to make progress. And in that sense, then, we can't really plan very far ahead at all. We can only take intermediate stepping stones, and the ones that we take might seem completely backwards.
Yeah, I guess I'm just not on the same page here. Because if I was Rembrandt and I was going to paint a portrait, he's going to start off by doing a rough sketch in pencil very lightly there, using all the techniques he's learned about, say, symmetry of human faces, how to do strokes that result in certain patterns on the page. He's going to build it up. Even some larger scale things like emotion to draw sort of a nice curved outline of the face, etc. And then he's going to know now he needs to start applying paint and work from the back to the front algorithmically with the background and combining strokes. When we go to build a bridge, a building, anything, like, this is all what engineering is about, is how do we break down analytically and codify the processes into repeatable modules, if you will, to achieve that goal.
Now, but that's different. It's already been achieved.
Yeah, but
is art an algorithm?
Yeah, like, so I mean,
would any artist make a good engineer, or are their patterns of thinking completely different?
I don't know, but that's not the point about Pick Breeder.
What you're saying, you could take a Rembrandt, and now we can do engineering on it, just like we do in software engineering projects. We can do a waterfall methodology, and we can structure. We've got one guy doing these strokes, and we break it down into the. That's completely different. But at some point, someone discovered how to paint in that way.
Yeah, but in Pick Breeder, he makes this comment that when people use this tool set using their natural proclivities, they don't end up with what they want. Well, here's the thing. When people use the tool set of the real world using our natural proclivities, we end up with what we want.
But we don't know what we want. If we know what we want, then we've already found it. The whole point of this is that there's an infinite space out there of possible innovations and inventions, and some of them are only one step away. There's a treasure hunt. That's what he says. There's all of these things that we've got, and we can use these things to take one stepping stone away, and we can find something amazing. But we have no conception of what they are yet. Otherwise, we'd go and do them.
I'm just attacking this Pick Breeder argument. I'm saying that the fact that people interacting with Pick Breeder in the whatever this way that comes natural to them doesn't end up with cool paintings says nothing about novelty search. Like, if I give you, you know, a whole bunch of truckloads of dynamite and then send you out and ask you to build a pyramid, and you find out that the only way you could get it was just by randomly throwing dynamite around, and after a long enough period of time you ended up with a pyramid, I'm going to say the problem isn't your algorithm choice, it's the tool set. Dynamite is not the right tool to build a pyramid. And Pick Breeder is not the right tool to create portraits.
It's possible that we haven't discovered something amazing on Pick Breeder yet, which could revolutionize the way that we do portraits. But anyway, just in closing, because we can't spend too much time on this, but he also cites the Finnish education system. They have this concept which imposes no standardization on tests or students at all. In fact, the system follows the spirit of non-objective search, and it's a world leader in education. Of course, it's this idea of creativity. Certainly, I've read a couple of papers on this where people say, oh, kids are actually very creative, and school conformalizes them and almost kills the creativity in our kids. So he says that the lesson is that silencing diversity is a surefire way to slow down progress.
Silence diversity, though. So here's his black and white. His entire book is so black and white, right? It's all a bunch of false dilemmas. Nobody's saying to silence diversity. People are saying that a combination of, let's call it novelty search plus objective optimization, is the way to go. that it isn't binary, black, white, do one or the other. And he constantly poses these false dilemmas. Just, I had a hard time reading the book because there was just faulty actual logic throughout the entire book. It was just a false dilemma, logical fallacy, one after another, until finally you're left just, oh, I guess I believe what he says because I've completely become untethered from any logic.
Interesting. Okay. We'll come back.
I'm just some guy.
I think we're all on board, though. The mixed approach is necessary. It's just how we respond to the actual arguments made that we differ in our viewpoints.
I think this is actually a wonderful metaphor for so many future conversations that we'll have. So we'll come back to that. But anyway, we've got about 50 minutes left, and we need to talk about capsule networks. God knows we need to talk about it because Keith and I earlier on were talking about affine transformations. We said, well, wouldn't it be wonderful if we had a computer vision algorithm that would be invariant to various different types of affine transformations? And then some smart aleck came on our YouTube comments and said, oh, that already exists. It's called capsule networks. Have you not looked at it yet? So we have actually looked at it today. We've been looking at it in some detail. And I suppose one of the starting concepts I want to talk about is this notion of equivariance and invariance. Because I hear this jargon bounded about quite a lot. And the difference is, right, so I've got a little thing here. For feature maps in convolutional neural networks to be useful, they typically need both properties in some balance, right, as in invariance and equivariance. The equivariance allows the network to generalize edge, texture, shape, detection in different locations, and the invariance allows precise locations of the detected features to matter less. These two are complementary types of generalization for many image processing tasks, right? So equivariance to translation means that a translation of input features results in an equivariant translation of the output. So if you have a pattern in this part of the input space and then you then change the input to move, you expect the response map to change with it. So a convolutional neural network layer is equivariant. Invariance to translation means that the translation of input features does not change the outputs at all. And that's what a convolutional neural network as a whole does, because you actually don't want it to be equivariant. You want, regardless of where the dog is on the input space, you want it to say dog. You don't want it to say, oh, it's a dog, but with a caveat.
Yeah, so I think you could just say equivariance is a generalization of invariance. So invariance is equivariance where the only transform you allow is the identity transformation. Mm. So you're just saying that the output is identical to what, whereas equivariance, it can be whatever, a linear, just some type of known transformation in the output. Yeah.
So we start going through the capsule nets. Big shout out to the YouTube comments, source of all wisdom in the world. But as we went into them, we started discovering that perhaps they're not invariant or equivariant as has been claimed. There's a lot of talk that they can exploit these sorts of affine transforms, these sorts of rotational symmetries that do exist in native photos, but
that's just a load of bollocks.
It's a load of words on a page and nothing mechanically actually resembles that.
Yeah, so to put maybe a more charitable spin on it, and by the way, I found this, you know, Jonathan Hui has this really cool blog post about capsule networks that, and the positive spin I take on is the goal of capsule networks to have this transformation matrix that operate on a pose, you know, to, let's just say, standardize or normalize the pose into an output. That's all great. If it's exactly what I had in mind with this affine invariant sort of transformations, I think the issue is that it's like, that's what a capsule should do. And a capsule network is a bunch of these capsules together. But when you get into the details of how to actually build that capsule, it's where it becomes much more difficult. It's like, yeah, we sort of got it to be affine invariant for some kind of pieces of that or within some range, but not at all scales or this type of thing. Like here, I'll give you like a simple example. Let's suppose that we have a capsule that recognizes houses. Okay, because at some lower level, there's some other capsules that recognize windows, doors, roof, etc. Suppose that house is centered in my frame of view, right? If I rotate that house around the center of the picture, okay, the there's going to be different rotations depending on the radius that you are out from that center for all these components. A door that's near the center will have a transformation matrix, a pose very similar to the house itself. But let's say on the outside, like on the outer corner, a window is going to have a pose that's very different from the pose of the door, the pose of the house as a whole. And it's not clear to me like what the math is behind all those combinations of poses. Like how do we handle larger scale rotations? It seems like an interesting direction to pursue. I think there's a lot of detail that I just don't know. But maybe it's out there and we need to do, I need to do a lot more homework. Or maybe it's still a difficult problem and it's not quite solved yet. I don't know.
So when I first had a glance at the Capsule Network's Wikipedia page, I thought it was doing something super clever like that. Oh, it has some kind of pose matrix and it's cleverly looking at loads of different affine transformations and poses. It's not. I can share Yannick's video. Obviously, Yannick Lightspeed Kilcher, he's made a video about absolutely bloody everything, including Capsule Networks.
Well, I'm going to give you this link if you don't have it already to Jonathan Hui's blog post because it's a great kind of explanation of it. We should put it in the YouTube description too.
Yeah, sure.
He's got one on both the dynamic routing and the EM matrix version of capsules.
Okay. We'll come to that in a second then. So let's just quickly skip through this. So the way Yannick explains this is that Capsule Networks, now first of all, CNNs already do this. CNNs learn features as part of the training process in a hierarchy. And you can't define what those features are a priori. They're just learned from the data. So they could be anything. So when we talk about these capsules as being features, we're talking hypothetically because it's probably not going to correspond to those features.
Can I jump in real quickly here? The front run a heap of the things that are going to come up. The problem is that these things are defined on vector spaces, just general vector spaces, as opposed to on manifolds. Because like poses transform very simply. They're really quite simple objects up to a scale factor. That was your how do things operate at different scales? They're undefined up to a scale, but like up to that point, they're very well understood objects. It's just when the capsule networks are saying, oh, we're estimating these quantities. No, you've got a 4x4 matrix under there whose elements are, you know, being optimized independently of one another. They're not transforming according to some underlying algebra. A lot of the problems are just coming from that, right? Like that they're not aware. Now, there are all of the algebra CNNs that live out there, the various ones that optimize over a manifold. They're doing some really cool work with capsule nets that are bringing it closer, like much, I guess what we're criticizing here is the overreaching claims of the original research. It's not that the idea is bad. Idea is actually really clever. It's just, it's not there yet.
I totally agree with you. And I think it's a very promising direction. And like I said, I don't know enough about it yet to say anything other than seems like a great path to pursue. Seems like there's a lot of work left to do. Would love to see more people interested in it and putting resource and thought into it. Because like it is explained on that blog post does a good job of explaining the exact problem I brought up many times with CNNs is that we're wasting parameter space learning things like a face at 0 degree orientation, a face at 20 degrees orientation. And that's all kind of hacked in Kluge anyway. It's not going to capture the true invariance of rotation. And so if we just build that in, however it's done, capsule networks,
But they don't. That's the thing.
Yeah.
They may not now, but they're thinking about it in a very, I think it's a very clear way to think about it, at least. It's just, maybe it's not there in an implementation yet.
I think it's not, and I'll explain why. So at the moment, we have these input capsules, and Yannick has said they might learn this kind of semantic information. So wall, roof, door, and lake, and so on. And then, of course, the main difference with these, as opposed, compared to CNNs, is these actually produce a vector of output. Mm-hmm. And this vector space here, and this is a two-dimensional vector space. So this is notionally angle and color. And the magnitude of this vector, first of all, it's normalized so that it's got length 1. So 1 means that the probability is very high. So if it's 1, it means I really think that this roof is here. But you can then use the direction in the other dimensions to ascertain things like the angle and the color. But you don't know what these things are. These are just learned. because these capsule networks are framed up as a way of giving you, let's say, affine invariance, but that's not the case at all. You still need to give it examples of your object being rotated in every possible way, which means it's still wasting the representational capacity of the CNN encoder exactly the same as it was before. The encoder here, every single capsule here, is a planar CNN, and it has all of the failings of planar CNNs.
Okay, so that's the part I wasn't clear on yet, because I hadn't studied enough, was I wasn't sure if that transformation matrix was something that was being estimated, like when it does a prediction. I wasn't sure if that was being estimated on the fly and then just essentially marginalized out, i.e. just do the maximum likelihood estimation of that matrix, apply it, then you get this output vector which goes on further into the network. Because if it was doing that, then that would buy you like true affine invariance, at least for all the data that was coming into that node. Or not quite affine invariance, but best estimation affine invariance. But what you're saying is it's developing some type of fixed transformation matrix based on input samples or something.
To fill in some gaps, just there may be some people out there that are a bit blank on details anyway. What you're doing with each of these capsules is you're taking a single input feature, like a single output, a single channel from another CNN, and then you're within the unit itself, you're notionally corresponding the pose of an input to the pose of the notion reflected by the node. So the relationship, the spatial relationship between the walls, the door, and the roof of the house to the idea of the house, right? You're not going to find the roof on the bottom unless the picture's upside down, in which case the door will be upside down as well. And so this idea of exploiting the geometric ordering of objects to build up these latent representations of objects is basically what's going on here.
And that's the interesting thing is it's not explicitly looking at the spatial relationship, although that's a likely side effect of the algorithm, depending on how you trained it. Because these dimensions on the vector could correspond to anything. It doesn't necessarily mean the spatial dimension. But the way that this has been pitched, though, by Hinton, is that at the moment, convolutional neural networks, they have this inductive prior, which it only recognizes spatial information locally. The whole idea of CNNs is to reduce the number of parameters in the network. We just have these tiny filters that we shine over the larger image, and that gives us this translational equivariance. But it also means that we cannot learn long-term spatial dependencies in the image. So you get all of these really weird things happen. Now, we can learn long-term spatial relationships in the image, but it's a bit different, because in a convolutional neural network, you have max pooling layers, and then eventually you have a densely connected network at the end. Yeah, yeah. And that can actually learn global relationships between things, but not in a spatial relation, only if they both exist. But remember, for a good CNN image classifier, we don't actually want it to be equivariant. We want it to be invariant at the end. We just want to know, is there an eye and is there a nose in the image? But then you get the Picasso problem, because it no longer learns the correct spatial relation between the eye and the nose.
Yeah. More and more people aren't so much interested in just an invariant label. More and more people want pixel-wise labels. And so that loss of spatial information becomes a real problem. And you end up using all these engineering hacks to get around that. To get around something that perhaps if CNNs were designed a little better, would be information that was preserved and exploited.
That's one thing I thought was pretty cool about the capsule network, at least formulation. And I have to keep prefacing this by saying I have a lot more homework to do. Okay, audience out there, take this for what it's worth. But what I thought was cool about is that it had this notion of a pose. And that if you could track that transformation matrix, and you could track the, it wasn't called voting, it was called something else, for kind of each feature would vote on the pose for the combined capsule at the higher layer and whatnot. And so you could keep track of all that and then just reverse the projections back down, do interesting things with the original pixels, like you were saying.
Yeah.
Look, maybe if we do enough homework, maybe we could convince Dr. Hinton to come on here and educate us and answer some questions for us, because I personally find it a pretty interesting intellectual framework to think about it. I just don't know enough about how far it's actually made it in implementation.
it hasn't made it very far. And even because the first thing is the first paper, I think, was what was the name of the paper? Can someone help me out here? I think it was this one. Yeah, Stacked Capsule Autoencoders. Yeah. And this was actually in about 2011. And the co-author, I think, was Krichevsky. Oh, no. Have I just hallucinated that? I'm sure Krichevsky. God, maybe this is another paper I was reading. I'm fairly sure it's Alex Krichevsky, who's, you know, the guy who won the ImageNet competition in 2012. But anyway, the key thing, though, is that they first published this long before the Vision and CNN revolution that we've had in the last 8 years or so.
Okay.
So coming into,
you know,
this
paper, but that could be, maybe that's the hardware lottery and or the attention lottery. I think in addition to a hardware lottery, we have attention lotteries. If everyone, most of the population's doing work on a certain line of research, it may just take a while for another to catch up.
Yeah, and so, credit where credit's due, this is an attempt to rethink something that's fairly fundamental to how computer vision's done these days. There are a lot of shades in this paper that are kind of coming up again. Oh, I can't remember the name, Axial Attention and Deep Lab. I started reading through these papers and I started seeing this connection between what's going on here and what they're trying to do with these pure attention-driven alternatives to CNNs. And at some point, I'm going to find some time and sit down and look into that a little bit deeper. But the idea is good. The idea is good. It's just when you dig into the actual implementation, it's a bit all over the shop.
And it's also they're trying to hard solve problems. Even with the paper we talked about with the circular harmonics for some degree of rotation invariance, at least at certain scales, if you start to try to think about, okay, how would I do that at all scales?
Yeah.
It starts to become quite difficult.
But it's quite interesting because all of that stuff by mostly Cohen and Welling, they were inspired by Hinton.
Oh, really?
So all of that stuff came from capsule networks. But I think Hinton was solving a completely different problem because they were directly trying to place inductive priors into the CNN models to make them equivariant. And I don't really see that in Hinton's architecture. This is more about learning the relationships between a hierarchy of things, but in a much richer semantic way. Let's just spend a little bit more time just quickly talking through this algorithm.
Can I point out something about that, though? I agree there's a lot of work on that. Let's say the first layer of capsules and above is what you're talking about there, like that the hierarchy, the semantic kind of combinations and whatnot. But the other half of it is what makes up a capsule. And so inside there, where you have this pose and the transformation matrix, you could see the circular harmonics is a different way of thinking about that. In addition, or maybe an augmentation to that, maybe we still have the pose and the transformation matrix. And in addition, we have some circular harmonics. And like, for example, maybe we would have even RGB stuff in there, like we're going to do a transformation to Scilab color space and do things like only care about the luminance and forget about A and B, or because we know that we're going to be doing the recognition in low light conditions and high light conditions or infrared or whatever. So I think it could be seen as an extension to that. But the fact that they were at least partly inspired by this work, I think, does point to there being value in this way of thinking about it, even if it leads to inspiration for other developments.
Yeah, absolutely. 100%. And it's undoubtable that capsule networks will be more sample efficient, but because of this routing algorithm, they're painfully slow.
Yeah, well, hey,
let's super quick.
It's a trade-off.
Isn't it always? So here's a super quick example of how this works. So you have an input image, and this is the classic MNIST. And lo and behold, we're still using planar 2D CNNs to do the encoding. And on this particular one, that they've got an output volume with a depth of 256. So they've got a whole bunch of different filters that they're learning. And the idea is that this output volume is going to be split up into what are called capsules. So we're still maintaining this kind of spatial domain. And this is a spatial domain of capsules that we are learning different features. And with some mathematical tricks, we can actually just maintain this in one huge matrix. But Yannick
Can I ask a question about that? And I'm hoping the two of you can educate me here. I could almost envision that each of these primary capsules, for example, could be completely independently trained neural networks. Like I'm going to go and create a data sample of just roofs and train it to recognize roofs. And then I'm going to reuse that as a capsule, like a fixed component of a neural network. I'm just curious, like how much work out there is being done at the moment with independently training subpieces of a larger neural network? Can you tell me?
It's transfer learning. The beauty of deep learning is the compositionality.
Well, the transfer learning, though, is I think transfer learning, as I've often seen it, is more on an entire network at a time. And then I'm just talking about training a training a network that recognizes only roofs, only doors, only this, and then combining those as just essentially neurons within a network. Are people doing that? Is that?
I haven't seen anything. I had a quick deep dive into this space this afternoon, and I didn't see anything like that, but I could definitely see something like that being worth a shot. It would definitely lead to some weirdness and some weird overfitting problems on like particular data sets. Add to the fact that capsule nets don't deal too well with multiple instantiations of the same object, and you're going to start running into problems fairly fast. But you know, as a line of future research, imagine a CNN, oh, we believe the following features are important. Throw them in from the standardized library, just one line of code, and download the pre-trained filters for whatever class of object you expect, and bring your data requirements down to like zero. That would be amazing.
You don't typically see that though. So at the moment, we have this beautiful flexibility in deep learning where you can compose together different networks that have been pre-trained, but usually it's for different domains. So you'd have a language processing encoder or a vision encoder or even speech recognition. And the reason why you tend to have monolithic networks across large domains is precisely because the networks are so good at reusing concepts and sharing sub-features in a hierarchy. Just like GPT-3, for example, it's got no problem at all eating up the entire internet and creating this beautiful hierarchy of shared concepts across there. So it would be a complete waste of a neural network to train one for dogs and one for cats. You might as well just throw it all in there together and it will structure it in this incredible way.
Yeah, I hear you about the entanglement, if you will, the entanglement between the different parts of the network buys you some compression, some efficiency. I'm not 100% sure that we wouldn't gain something else like these invariants or maybe even, for example, maybe you could use much simpler networks to recognize just these subcomponents and then combine them. So even though we wouldn't gain from the entanglement, reuse, and compression, we could actually gain by having much simpler or smaller parameter spaces, and then maybe they'd be more parsimonious. I don't know. I'm just curious how much work out there was being done in combining independently trained networks into larger networks.
You got to admit, the idea of like compositionality here, it's an elegant one. It's a really nice one that kind of appeals to the human idea of like what intelligence could do and what it could be. And the space of possibility that it opens up is pretty amazing. But yeah, as far as I've seen, there's nothing in that space at the moment.
Okay. All right. So if I have to go back to school, that would be a good research paradigm to follow then.
Potentially. I wouldn't listen to my advice on what research paradigm to follow. I'm more of a stepping stone skipper myself.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Skipper.
Novelty searcher.
Treasure hunting. But anyway, clearly what we need to do here is learn a whole bunch of weight matrices. And this is standard neural network stuff to transform all of these vectors. So we normalize them, as we said, and then we'd want to transform them into these outputs. And this is where this clever routing algorithm thing comes in. And again, we need to have a way of transforming these. Now, what we already do is we learn a bunch of transformation matrices, right? Weight matrices to transform from these blocks into these rows over here. And this is where this routing algorithm comes in, right? So the way that Yannick sketched it is, rather than just doing this in one step, go and then eventually it goes over here. And also there's a relationship between the two layers, because you need to know what the output of the next capsule is, because essentially this is looking at correspondence. It's saying, I want to learn the correspondence to maximally map the outputs of the capsules on the left to the outputs on the right. And turns out, actually, this is very similar to the way transformers work. But transformers don't work in this kind of weird feature space. They work on tokens. But the routing algorithm with the queries and the keys and so on is all about seeing from the perspective of this word, which words coming in correspond to me. And this is saying from the perspective of the house, which one looks like a roof, right? So what this is doing is it's looking, it's learning a kind of attention vector on all of these capsules. So it knows which in capsules should I pay attention to. So it's not just the weight matrices, it's also learning this attention thing. And would you like to give us some elevator pitch on this, Alex?
Oh, no, I really don't. I think this idea is insane. There is a bit of secret sauce that goes into this. The attention that is learned for the mapping between I and J on our screen here depends on the output of J. It's like a cosine similarity between the transition matrix between I and J and the output of J itself. So you have to first calculate Wij and then get what Yannick called, I think he called it OJ at the...
We can do that. We can go forward a bit.
There we go. Beautiful.
So we've got all of the capsules coming in. So we have a quadratic number of weight matrices. And for this capsule coming in, we've got all the weight matrices for all of the other in capsules. And then we can multiply, we can take the scalar product and we get this OJ.
And then we check the inner product between OJ and every single one of those outputs to decide which ones mattered for the overall pose of the concept. And then use that, we go back and we reweight our inputs based on that.
Exactly.
And we do this iteratively.
All of these dot products, they'll be high if there's a high correspondence. But then we update this attention thing and then we rinse and repeat a few times. And then eventually only the ones that, and then I think we take a softmax at some point, but eventually only the capsules that have a high correspondence in coming into this capsule will be weighted on that attention vector. And that's basically,
it's almost an attempt to obtain a sparse solution, like by
but via expectation maximization during optimization, and like it's an inner optimization loop inside your optimization loop that you even have to do at test time. It's bonkers. Like, why can't this be done end to end? Surely there is a way to do this end to end.
Yeah, it has to be done at test time as well.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I have a lot more homework to do with capsule network. So
does it have to be? I didn't think it had to be done at test time.
It has to be done at test time.
What, this routing thing? But we've already learned the weight matrix, matrix.
Yeah, but we're not updating the weights. We're updating the attention, and that's done using EM on every forward pass. That's why I was checking the code earlier, just because I read this. I'm like, surely they're not doing this, and sure enough, they're doing it.
Well, there you go. But I wanted to show, because the way they compute the loss on this when you actually update the gradients is they also use this reconstructed loss as well. So they've changed the architecture to use a densely connected neural network to recreate the input image, and then they have a reconstructive loss. But they multiply that by about 0.005 or something, and then they use a loss against the actual learned features, don't they? But this is quite interesting.
The loss they're using is just, it's a fairly simple contrastive loss. If you've ever played around with self-supervised stuff, it looks like triple loss only. Margin loss, but in a contrastive format against the negative classes.
Yeah, this guy. And they want to make it between 0.1 and 0.9. And presumably that's so that they can use it in conjunction with the reconstructed loss. Yeah, so this guy. So this is the margin loss.
The thought behind using the reconstruction loss is really clever. That's taking the idea of the inverse computer graphics and just running with it. We've got this boiled down representation of an object and its pose, and theoretically that should be enough to reconstruct and render that object and then do some, you know, loss function with it. The problem is, of course, that minor changes in that sort of pose space, like this is why all these pose invariant networks are proposed, right? Minor changes in that pose matrix space lead to huge changes in the projection onto the pixel matrix, the pixel space, right? So even though it is this beautiful, elegant idea that in theory is wonderful, like a real proof of concept of this idea of encapsulating objects within the matrix. In practice, it's almost got no way of practically working. It'll give you a vague, fuzzy blob on the screen where an object should be. And if you're lucky, it may resemble the pose. But
yeah,
for anything more than MNIST, that's a shot in the dark.
This thing's quite interesting. So on this one, it's actually showing, so it's the LPR, right, which is the label predicted and the reconstructed. And when there's not a correspondence, so when it predicted the wrong thing, you can see some interesting points of confusion. So here, for example, the label was a 5 and it predicted a 3. And you can see that the reconstructed output shows something that looks very confused between a 3 and a 5.
Yep.
And another thing that they show in the paper is, because the whole point of this is about learning various different types of transformations or semantically equivalent transformations. And I think it's been understood by many to mean things like rotation and variance and stuff like that. But it's not. I think this shows quite clearly, because what they've done here is on the reconstructed, because essentially this is a bit like an autoencoder. So you can, across these capsule dimensions, you can reconstruct different variations of the image. And these are showing what the type of transformations look like. And it's stuff like stroke thickness, localized skew. So you can see on this one, across the domain of this capsule dimension, you can see the 4 is becoming more skewed. As you'll notice, there's no rotation going on here. And why would there be? Because MNIST doesn't have any rotations. So what it's doing is it's learning dimensions of difference that are semantically relevant to the data that it's seeing.
Yeah, so those last, like the 4s in particular, so the localized skew. In time series analysis, for example, there's a thing called dynamic time warping. So the idea is that on the time axis, you can, as long as you're doing transformations that don't result in any cuts to the timeline, so you're just sort of compressing certain areas or warping and whatnot, spreading, making thinner, that there's a lot of time series that actually have that structure. Like for one reason or another, the flow of time for whatever process it is that you're observing isn't uniform with calendar time. Like stock market, for example, that there can be periods of very high volatility taking place within a few minutes after some announcement. And so you operationally get a lot more time within that piece of calendar time than you did for all the morning before the announcement or whatnot. And similar types of things occur as well. And just are in image, you know, capture, for example, you have a drop of water on the lens and it results in the continuous warping of that little piece there. So far, we've mostly been talking about affine invariance and our kind of transformation discussions, because I was just trying to focus on a simple one that to get everybody convinced that they should try to work that into their neural network kind of paradigms. But all these other kinds of transformations are also very real and useful. So interesting that the capsule networks were finding some of those.
Well, I think I'm being a little bit unfair, because first of all, it's really interesting what you say about the dynamic time warping, because as you say, there are lots of interesting sequence alignment problems that you get with time series. But in this particular case, capsule networks could learn a rotational affine transformation if you gave it data. And the key thing is that it would then become one of these capsule dimensions, and you could then commute across those transformations. So it would learn it as a first-class citizen. But the key thing is, because of that planar convolutional encoder, it would waste a shitload of representational capacity to learn all of those different versions coming in.
Yeah, that's the part that I wasn't so clear on how that was, because I haven't done enough homework, how that was being handled, and maybe it's not being handled. It sounds like there's a lot of work to be done, but I think it's a good kind of initial framework to ponder these deeper questions.
It is worth noting, we're talking about vectors here. And vectors are much simpler to discuss the concept, because we can use, like, the extension that I'm about to talk about has a lot of engineering hacks baked into it to make it work with matrices. But they recognize that, hey, we can't actually capture 3D transformations or like rigid transformations with an eight element vector. I think how many degrees of freedom is there in a 3D rotation and translation? Like 15? I think there's 15. So they instead said, hey, let's actually start thinking about this in terms of these pose matrices. And so they built a follow-up paper to this, adds an extra dimension to your feature maps, and all of a sudden you're working with pose matrices of various objects. Now, whether or not they're actually doing that, I'm very much of the opinion that they're probably not, although there have been papers released that have tried to explicitly encode this information. But they're definitely thinking through these problems and trying to make it more reflect this kind of quest for an object-wise invariance. Like, it's there. Having dismissed the concept very early on, I should be a little even-handed and say there are some very good ideas there, and they are developing in this direction that mm-hmm. you've expressed. But yeah, they're just not there quite yet.
Yeah, and so to the degrees of freedom, I'm virtually certain everything can fit within a 4x4 matrix. And I don't think you don't need all 16 elements. So it's down to 3D transformations, affine transformations, or 11 or 12 or something degrees of freedom. And I think in that 4x4 matrix, you may even be able to work in a couple other transformations
It's projection distortions. Or whatever.
I second what you're saying, which is I think it's a good framework to start with, and there's probably just a lot of work that hasn't been done. And you know, Tim, like you said a couple times, the implementation is probably hasn't come a long way yet, but I'd love to see a lot more work into it, honestly.
I think we need both, though, because remember, in the real world, there is a kind of topological relationship between objects, and that's super important. And I think captural networks are going a long way in that direction. I think we shouldn't confuse that with the direction that Cohen and Welland have gone in. I mean, this is a set of slides, I think, from Max Welling. And the idea is that, first of all, it depends on the data domain. So are you on a manifold? Are you on a graph? Mm-hmm. Are you in a geometric space? And there'll be all sorts of objects in those substrates that you could do what I would call a semantically equivalent transformation. So think of a graph, for example. You could represent the same graph in a completely different way in that adjacency matrix, and your graph CNN will just think that's a completely new graph. So when you're modeling graphs, you need to have permutation equivariance. And what we're really driving towards here is really clever inductive priors that mean we don't need to have such a huge representational capacity to basically record many simulacrums of the same thing.
Sure. And another interesting thing to keep in mind, too, is that, and this is what's kind of cool about the capsule networks, is that since they are recording, if you will, at some point, the transformations, and there's the potential to have them propagate around and whatnot. What's really useful about that is sometimes you actually do care about, like, for example, if I'm trying to distinguish between an airplane versus a model airplane, I don't want scale invariance because the scale information is an important piece of that criteria. Maybe I need some type of yardstick or whatever to normalize it, but I need to know what that scale is. I don't want a network that actually, it's fine if a part of the network is invariant or equivariant to that, but I need to have access to that information so that I can have another node that's telling me whether or not it's actually maybe a model airplane and not, or a drone instead of a human piloted airplane, that sort of thing.
One teensy tiny problem there. Like this is a really good point, but I think most of these transforms are only defined up to a scale. Like generally you normalize the transformation matrix to have the bottom right entry equal one. It's your scale factor. How would you even represent that and then still have it live on these manifold of valid geometric transformations?
Just relax that constraint. Don't force W or whatever that component is to be one. Allow it to
you reckon it'd be that value. Simple?
Simple for what purpose? I don't know. But
that wasn't facetious. I genuinely don't
know. You can always choose to renormalize. So if you've got W something else besides one, and if it and again, we're talking about like in the context of neural networks, so who knows what they're going to choose to do. But my point is that in theory, they could choose to always normalize back to one. So a group of nodes could decide that they're ignoring the scale for their purpose, but another group of nodes could decide that that is important for classifying whether this is a model airplane or whatnot. So I just think it's cool that capsule networks maybe have built in the idea that this is information that needs to be explicitly available or tracked and not just disappearing into the kind of mesh, if you will.
Yeah.
So we've got 7 minutes. What are we going to talk about now, Tim? What can we talk about in 7 minutes? Something controversial, maybe.
We could take some more pot shots at Hinton.
No pot
That'll
shots.
That'll encourage him to come on later.
Let's learn more and ask him to come set us right and tell us, tell us, you know.
Do you think that he's not going to be sending us any Christmas cards this year?
I admit, I don't know nearly enough to pass. And again, I've only said that.
Oh, we don't either. We're just,
this is a promising kind of intellectual framework. It just seems there needs to be a lot more work done on it. And it's like this attention lottery and hardware lottery. Let's try to roll that again, get some more attention on this.
It is funny, though, how we see concepts just coming up time and time again, because it's very closely related, I think, to the attention is all you need. And because we only really looked at this today, and we recognized quite a lot of concepts. And I'll be the first to admit that we may well have misunderstood some of the things here, but it has been really interesting learning about this.
Yeah.
One thing that kind of I'm increasingly noticing, I've spent a lot of time thinking about making algorithms faster lately and how to accelerate algorithms that are just considered too slow to use, but just really haven't had the time put into them. And this was a really good example today. Like, a lot of the implementations of this idea involve hacking around pre-built TensorFlow components. And to an extent, like, having these components accessible is great. It's massively accelerated research for the entire community. It allows everyone to get their feet wet. But like, the kinds of people who used to work in CAFE, the types of people that used to just code in pure C or C++, it's taught in all the universities over here.
Because it's
out.
A secret weapon, that's why. It's awesome. I love it.
I'm coming around to it. Like, I've been starting to program in it because there are a lot of things that are really slow until you just get your hands dirty, go out and build a proper computer kernel, and then put the Python bindings in. All of a sudden, it's lightning fast. And so these capsule networks, I'm laughing earlier about, it's got a loop within a loop. There's no new information going into that. How much slower would this be if, instead of doing it the way that's done in terms of these matrix multiplications, constantly handing the data back and forth between the GPU, if you were to just build a dedicated kernel, hand the data across once, do the entire optimization, then hand it back to Python? Maybe this wouldn't seem like such a ridiculous, clunky process. Maybe it's just we're all, as researchers, as practitioners, we've all gotten a bit lazy and a bit coddled with the fantastic libraries that we have.
Well, though, we've been reading Sarah Hooker's Hardware Lottery, and the thesis on that is that she argues that it was hugely serendipitous that the deep learning revolution happened, because we just happened to have these GPUs that were optimized for people to play games on their machines. And then obviously Alex Krichevsky or whoever it was used CUDA and won the ImageNet competition as a result. And apparently the generalist concept of CPUs was because in the early days, when they built a specialist CPU to do something, it would be superseded the next year by the generalist CPU.
Yeah, now that Moore's Law it's slowed down, at least it seems like it has to me in terms of the growth of processor speeds and whatnot. Now we're starting to consider much more dedicated hardware, whether it's in the form of FPGAs, though, that are programmable to be dedicated, if you will, or for certain classes of problems, they're very profitable. Let's say Bitcoin mining. Let's get some ASICs dedicated for that. Yeah.
So on that, because that's actually super interesting, because I know Microsoft released Project Brainwave a couple of years ago, which is their ASICs, and then we've got Google's TPUs. Intel have just people keep talking about neuromorphic chips, and I thought, God, is that something that I just don't know about? Am I missing a trick here?
Tesla's running them in their vehicles at the moment, like dedicated neural network architected chipsets for like massively accelerated computation. Chips built like neural networks.
No, I don't. But that's the way it was framed to me. People said, this is some amazing revolution in AI. We've got the chips that they're just like human brains, but on a chip. But that's not true at all, is it?
I'm not a hardware guy. I used to work with a guy who was a hardware guy who had his hands on some of these cutting edge neuromorphic GPUs. But they were really just, they were optimized for neural networks rather than general restricted instruction set computations. And so a lot of what I'm reading about neuromorphic computing falls into two categories: the actual neurobiology inspired stuff, that sort of research space. And then there's the stuff that's out there in industry at the moment, which just seems to be more like purpose built for the deep learning paradigm. The latter form you see a lot more, but there is like explicit neuromorphic stuff that is cool in terms of how they mimic biological processes at the transistor level.
I'm just a little bit worried about this because whenever people talk about deep learning, especially if they're selling it, they anthropomorphize it. And all of the kind of chips specialized for running neural network models, in my experience, they're kind of FPGA type things. And is it just that?
Well, whatever it is, if I could convince our listeners of one thing, there are no silver bullets. Okay, like end of story. So I used to work mainly in biomedical research or bioengineering. And it seemed every month there was a quote, cure for cancer, right? Well, the first thing is cancer is a whole population and spectrum of diseases. Like there's some cancers that are very treatable, some that are not treatable at all. And a lot of this is just the sort of normal hype cycle that people always go through. New cure for cancer this month. It's the same thing here, right? Like people are trying to hype up whatever it is that they're working on and present it as the next greatest sort of silver bullet. There are no silver bullets, folks. There will always be fundamental trade-offs between time, space, energy, et cetera. And there's no magic chip that's going to come somehow elevate us out of that. Okay. Like quantum computing. There's all these misconceptions about quantum computing. Okay. Like
you took the words out of my mouth.
Yeah. Quantum computing. Look, we understand the theory of quantum computing quite well. We can't build chips that well for quantum computing, but we understand the theory, and that's kind of computation or theory of computation. Those folks understand the complexity class of quantum computing that it can solve in linear time. It's QP. I think QP or whatever, and there's QP complete problems and whatnot. I got bad news for you. That's not a very big space of problems in the space of all problems. Okay, so quantum computing is not suddenly going to just, we're not going to solve global warming with it. Okay, it can do some things much better than classical computers, but only a small sliver of things in the space of all types of computational problems.
It is interesting, though, on more than one occasion, I've found myself looking for hypothetical probability distributions that don't exist. And it's like you're faced with the choice of, do you use a Gaussian copula or do you go looking for the right thing? And every time I've encountered one of those problems, it's turned out I've required some kind of quantum system to get the actual probability distribution. And at first I thought quantum computing, it's this absolute BS term that people are just using to sell hardware. Google's using it to promote themselves. But it's even though, yes, there's Shor's algorithm and what else, like nothing. But it still comes up in very interesting and unusual places, like estimating the co-occurrence of methylation on DNA.
But right, see, that's because of the domain that you're working in. So when you're working on modeling physical systems, which are quantum, it shouldn't be surprising that the problems you need to solve might map well to quantum computing.
It's just the getting covariance into discrete systems, like continuous covariance into discrete systems is difficult. And so usually you hack around it. But if you want an actual correlated discrete random variable, you find yourself wandering into quantum space very quickly.
Sure. Yeah, so there are a lot of natural things that arise that map well that space. I'm only pointing out that the complexity class, QP, for those out there, go look it up sometime, what the QP complexity class is and how it fits in the Venn diagram of all sort of computational classes, and you'll be a little less silver bullet enthusiastic about what quantum computing is going to do for the world.
I will say, I know a professor at the University of Queensland. Her name's Sally Shrapnel. She is, without a shadow of a doubt, one of the most accomplished people I've ever met. Like, seriously, started at, I think it was King's College doing philosophy, casually, over a couple of years, did a medical degree, got married, raising kids, went back to uni doing a PhD on quantum causality, and then is now working in quantum artificial intelligence.
Overachievers.
But like, she's so awesome. she has some really interesting things to say about, you know, this quantum computing malarkey. She'll point out that until there are stable qubits, it's a myth. It's all hypothetical. You can't do anything useful until they're stable, and then you need error correcting codes, which interferes with your computations. That being said, she does stuff like simulates neural networks using like ion traps and stuff like that. And the neat thing about how that kind of works is that it automatically optimizes, because it's just an energy function that gets minimized. And so like there is some cool stuff there. It's not all marketing hype, but don't believe marketing hype.
Yeah, and for example, we've talked a couple times about Turing machines and Turing complete. And so it's a natural question to wonder, is there anything more powerful than a Turing machine? And is there something that can do hyper computation? And if you will, one example of such a theoretical machine is called a real computer. And it's an idealization of an analog computer. So it's basically a computer that has these real function, can perform these real functions on real variables to arbitrary precision, infinite precision or whatever, and polynomial time. And if you just have that, then you have forms of computation that are hypercomputation. But can we ever actually get to that? I think there's a lot of good evidence that the answer is no, that we're forever going to be stuck with essentially what at the end of the day a Turing machine could do in an infinite amount of time, or a potentially infinite amount of time rather than actually having run for an infinite amount of time. So we're just stuck in this. There is no hypercomputation. That's one possible answer for the universe, if you will.
Awesome. Gentlemen, to infinity and beyond. It's been a fantastic conversation today. And what I'll say, for folks that have made it this far, if you would like to suggest something for us to talk about, maybe come and join us on the Star Trek Enterprise, or give us a philosophical topic, a topic to discuss, then we will do that.
That's a cool idea. Like we could pose, maybe we can do a little straw poll too. Once we get some topic ideas, put up a straw poll, see what people want us to talk about.
And within reason,
I think we're going to need to come back around for these algebra, that the group CNNs, take a closer look at them and see where they're leading. Because the capsule nets didn't get us there, but we know where the next step is.
Let's talk more about Bayesian too. Marginalization, model selection, probability theory is logic. Those would be fun topics.
Oh, let's just bust out the probability textbooks. Let's do some fundamental proofs.
Let's do it on a whiteboard to demonstrate that we actually can still do math, or at least Mathematica. We'll do some live Mathematica solving.
I was so embarrassed after our conversation last week. I immediately bought Bayesian Data Analysis 3. And then Keith said to me, "Tim, what are you doing, man? You need to go and buy Sylvia." So I did. Civia. I bought Civia. So I bought Data Analysis, a Bayesian tutorial. And I've already started reading it, actually. And it's super interesting. I'm going to be completely converted to Bayesian.
I recommend that book, that Data Analysis of Bayesian Tutorial. I think model selection is early on. It's like chapter 2 or 3 or something, right? You really only need to read the first few chapters of that book to radically change the way you think about statistics, analysis, probability theory, if you've never been exposed to it.
We can tell that Tim hasn't been reading too much, because he still believes in absolute probabilities rather than just very close to 0 or 1. We're not getting 0 or 1 today on his prior.
0 to 1 probability, that's not the only formulation. There's equivalent formulations of probability theory where it goes from minus infinity to infinity, or 0 to infinity. Yeah, of course, all the other formulas change. You know, the sum rule, the product rule, whatever. But
we don't need them.
But we can make it appear like
we don't need maths. Yeah, we've got infinite computers. We're fine.
Cool.
It's optical. Let me just say one funny thing. The teacher I had for, I think, Thermodynamics 1 or something, this really funny guy, used to be a tank commander and, you know, became professor. And one day he was doing some integral, and the integral diverged. And he's, "So it looks like this explodes, but this is an optical explosion, because I could do this change to it, and now it becomes a convergent, you know, integral optical explosion." That's what those infinities are. Optical infinity.
Gentlemen, it's been a pleasure. We are going to be back next week where we are going to start debating the social dilemma.
Ooh. Oh,
yeah. I'll leave that with you. Peace out, folks.
Catch you later.
Catch you.